comics,
movies,
music,
video games,
technology,
Blu-ray,
television.
This is the HHW LOD Podcast Network.
Recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and Abe is still not here, but I have others joining me anyway. This is the second installment of our Out Now bonus horror series, where we're going over a couple decades of horror each week for the month of October this year. Last week we did the early years of horror. We talked about the 20s through the 40s. This week we're talking about the 50s and the 60s, which gives us kind of Hammer horror, Vincent Price, sci-fi, the third dimension, and more. And joining me once again, we have from Star Pulse, Jason Coleman.
I am indeed here. And see, the 50s and 60s were so scary that Abe refused to come. So.
Yeah, this is scarier than last time. He's even more scared now. That was the thing.
Hey.
He's plagued by Klaatu in his dreams. It's also, we have from Naptown Nerd and Why So Blue, Brandon Peters.
Good morning, afternoon, evening. And unlike Abe, I ain't scared of no podcast.
And joining us now, finally, we have from JoeBlow.com, Jimmy O.
Oh, I'm actually on set. I don't know if I can talk to you guys.
All right. So we finally assembled.
He's gracing us with his presence.
Yeah, this is a special bonus for us. Yeah,
Avengers assembled. Let's do this.
We each put in a lot of money into a pool and gave it to the Jimmy needs to be on this podcast program.
Damn, I lost.
Given that he inspired the idea for this podcast series, but here we are. We finally got the full crew together, and we can talk about the 50s and 60s in horror. And yeah, that's the plan this week. I mean, we're just going to kind of jump right in again, and so let's start in it. So. We left off, we were at the 40s. We got through that. There's a lot of like Universal Monster movies. That was kind of where
they're teaming up.
Teaming up, sequels and what have you. Now we get to the 50s. And things take a turn in the 50s. Like the monsters are still they're still around, right?
Yeah.
But they're more reflective of like world events.
Yes, it was the atomic age. Everyone was afraid of the atomic bomb, so you had all these mutants, and I don't know about you, a lot of these movies I kind of grew up on TV, because you know, this stuff, giant monsters, man, I was sure that we were going to get attacked by giant spiders. I was sure of that. In fact, I still am.
Which one's the spider one? Is that them or is
them?
That
the,
no, them wasn't spiders. Them was
the first
was
the first bug flick. Go ahead.
It was the first bug flick. Yeah. The spiders were, blah, 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 blah. They had,
Tarantula,
which is cool. Them is awesome. That was the giant ants, correct?
Yes.
Yes. I like big bugs.
They cannot lie.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't get more human-headed than, of course, the classic 1958 film The Fly.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
We're now combining human and bugs. So.
Yes. It's the atomic age.
Well, just giant stuff, right? Because you have the Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. I mean, that's another one of
I mean, go for broke. The Blob, of course.
Yes.
Steve McQueen as opposed to Steve McQueen.
I watched that movie pretty recently on the Criterion Blue. It's really colorful. That's like my main takeaway from that movie. It's a very colorful movie. It's like a greaser movie, except instead of, you know, hot rods racing at the end, it's a giant blob monster that's around, but it's like very like a lot of primary colors, the soundtrack's a lot of poppy fun. Like it's a fun little movie.
No, it was you know, it was one of the first it was one of those great teenage movies that wanted all the young people to come and go, oh, look, you can be scared of the giant thingy, giant jello, or pudding. I know what it was.
It was something like
pudding or jello. Or glob. That's why it's called the blob.
Getting back to giant monsters, we do also have Godzilla, of course, which is over
Godzilla
in Japan.
Yes. Right?
Suddenly we all go silent. Godzilla, the original film was such a... It's still one that kind of haunts me. It was such a powerful film when I first saw it. And now I'm kind of, you know, I grew up watching all the little Mothra and all the sequels and kind of being inspired by that and thinking how cool it would be.
It's funny, I grew up with all the kind of the sequel Godzilla movies, the ones that, you know, are not serious. And I have a weird, like, knowledge of those movies because when I saw the new Godzilla, I was, like, recalling these past films and writing about those things. It's like, mm-hmm. I have a lot more knowledge about these other Godzilla movies than I thought I did. And, like, yeah, I think that stems from the fact that I grew up watching, you know, being rather excited about seeing these ones on TV or whatnot. I was like, who's he fighting this time? And there's Biollante. It's like, that's something. Okay. But then, yeah, when Godzilla has an amazing Criterion release that came out a few years back, and I was watching that when it came out. I've seen that movie before, but, you know, watching it at the age I was, you know, a couple years ago, certainly more mature than when I was a child. And, yeah, that movie, it is quite haunting. And it is, I mean, there's an aspect to it that, of course, you can't get past when it comes to seeing a giant rubber guy in a suit. But at the same time, it's played so, there's such a solemn tone, and it can be quite, you know, saddening to watch this monster that's just wrecking everything. People are trying to, they don't know what to do. And there's, you know, it obviously reflects the age, the atomic age, as you mentioned, just this kind of state of disarray, especially Japan was in, where it's like, we don't know how to respond to this terrible thing that happened to us. So we'll make this movie because it's the only way we can really satirize the time. And this is the result. And now we have to know this, 50, 60 year legacy of this 70 year? It's got Godzilla 54.
Yeah. God, don't ask me to do that. It's way too early.
That was my sneaky way of getting Jimmy upset by asking him to do that.
Don't do that, my friend.
But it's interesting, that idea of fear. You know, fear is very, very prominent, I would think, in the 1950s, not only from little things, you know, like how their reaction with Godzilla to, you know, the Thing from Another World was at the beginning of the year. And then Body Snatchers, you know, Donald Sunsegel's Body Snatchers in 1956. So
Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That was also, I mean, I think it was you, Brendan, that said this was very, very relevant for the time. I mean, there was the fear of communism. There's all this weird stuff going on, and it really was reflected in horror.
Yeah.
I would say, and I don't know if you talked about that in the last podcast. I don't remember that. Did you talk about the connection with politics and horror?
I don't think we got into societal commentary too much in the last episode, because I don't think it really was as present as it is very clearly.
No, I don't think it was. Yeah, I think it really, I mean, it literally, literally every horror movie seemed to come from that. Aside from, you know, maybe the Tingler or something like that.
No, the Tingler is attacking feminism. I don't know.
Yeah, there you go.
The Tingler and Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Of course, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, one of my favorites. I love Plan 9 from Outer Space so much.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm trying to, like, I'm sure, you know, there's people that have researched this much more than we have in doing these podcasts that can talk about what kind of influences from culture on a more political commentary level made an impact on the horror films of the 40s, 30s, and 20s. But yeah, the 50s, it really seems, it at least seems very obvious. Like, I can't think of the obvious notions we're pointing at in the 40s or the 30s, but in the 50s, it seems very clear that there's paranoia regarding communism, regarding the Cold War, and, you know, the atomic age and things of that nature. It seems very clear that the 50s are, you know, it's a giant melting pot of ideas when it comes to putting societal commentary, politics, and whatever into the guise of these sci-fi and horror films that are coming out.
Yeah. Well, it's lasted, too. Go ahead, bro.
Well, I was just going to say, the 50s, more than any probably decade in horror, where the majority of the films are, like, products of their time, and there's, like, a less timelessness to, I mean, even some of the better ones than the other decades, where, you know, every one of them has a product of their time, but whether some hold up or not, or whatever, you know, I don't see anyone getting incredibly scared by a lot of the films of the 50s still to this day, whereas, like, something like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre could still be effective regardless of where time and place.
Yeah, it's more like the concepts certainly seem scarier than the actual, like, movies themselves. Like, something like The Thing is a good example, because The Thing, and we'll get to that when we get to the 80s as well, but The Thing the idea of that movie, of this kind of some kind of creature burying itself inside of humans, and you never know who's the one you should look out for. That's scary. That's a scary idea.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
a creature from the Black Lagoon. I mean, that's scary too. Yeah. I mean, if you're in the ocean, suddenly a crazy thing came out and grabbed you. It's like, that's, I don't need that in my life. But I mean, yeah, well, I mean, watching these movies, like, all right, yeah, this is like cool and the concept and whatnot, but scaring, literally scaring you, that's a bit of a stretch. But yeah,
they seem more a little bit like out there, and there's a lot of like heavy sci-fi influence on stuff too, which can in turn make things a little goofier in the latter part. Like a lot of my experience, you know, I've watched some of these films, you know, growing up and stuff too, but more of them come from watching their trailers too. And also Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah.
Basically made a career off a lot of these films.
How do you guys feel about that? I mean, I remember when the film came out, when the Mystery Science Theater film came out, This Island Earth.
Yes. Yeah.
A lot of people kind of felt a little bit, hey, these are classics in their own right. Did you feel any kind of like, yeah?
Well, This Island Earth was done against their own will. They didn't want to do that movie, and the studio forced them to put something more known. And they didn't want to do that, but then they did do it, and they got all their jokes reversed by the studio exec notes, and they weren't happy about that film too much either.
Yeah, I mean, that's my main takeaway is that they do films that generally aren't regarded very well to begin with. I mean, short of something like, well, even that's not even Mystery Science Theater anymore. Like things like Manos and Plan 9, because those are riff tracks movies. But I mean, the ones that they're doing for the show, they didn't really.
Yeah, they were usually a little bit not quite as...
They're a little more underground or a little more... Yeah, they weren't respected films of the 50s. Not that... And I mean, even then, it's not like they're doing it out of, like, you know, to harm these people or anything. It's doing it out of good fun. And,
oh, yes, they are. Yeah. I want to destroy them.
I mean, at least they were getting... I mean, at least people were, you know, seeing them in some form, so...
That's true.
But you know, I was going to say, one of the big staples of the 50s in terms of actors... would be Vincent Price. I mean, he really had quite a cachet of movies that year.
Mm-hmm. House of Wax.
Yeah. Return of the Fly. Not quite as good, but still good.
I would say the House of Wax was one of the first horror films I'd ever seen in it. Yeah, that one honestly terrified the crap. I think that's still pretty creepy.
Yeah, that one still actually worked pretty well.
Did you see it in the third dimension?
Yes, I did. I saw it. I saw it in one of those retro theaters, and it was in 3D, and it was surprisingly cool. It was a really awesome movie-going experience.
House of Wax was apparently the first color 3D film from a major American studio, which came after The Man in the Dark, which was the first major studio black and white 3D feature. And
Paris Hilton wasn't in the Vincent Price version.
No, but her father was. It was crazy. It was an ode to him, I believe.
Yes.
See, and it's interesting that you talk about the 3D, you know, because again, we were talking last week a little bit about showmanship, and of course, this was sort of the start of William Castle and his kind of thing with showmanship. He had done, you know, two films. I mean, he did much more in the 60s, but the two films that he did in the 50s were House on the Beyond style was House on Haunted Hill, which he did in Imergo, shot in Imergo. And it was and they still do that sometimes here, where it's a skeleton with the red eye sockets. Yeah. They put it on a wire and it floats over the audience. And then the other one was The Tingler. And it was shot in Percepto, and that's the one where they had kind of the buzzers under the seats. So I love that. So, you know, William Castle sort of in the 50s kind of started a little bit of that showmanship and kept it going in the 60s as well. So.
I could see why that wouldn't be like here today, but I certainly admire kind of those kind of 4D experiences like theme parks and stuff that try to recreate, you know, that kind of pulling in the audience even further by having those kind of things take place.
Right. I mean, I think they're, in many ways, they're trying to bring it back. But like you said, it's more theme parks. But I wouldn't be surprised if we would see that. Some guy come along and do something amazing like that.
Well, we have D-Box.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've never been to a D-Box, but I'm sure it does its job.
It's okay.
Okay. But then you have, like what, the Transformers have, like, the 4D experience or whatever?
But I don't know. That's like putting you know, Band-Aid on a severed arm. You're talking about a little box that goes in front of you that spews wind and water at your face. I don't know. I don't think it has quite the same effect.
It also lacks the heart and the kind of, it feels so just, I don't know, it's
too manufactured. Like, it's not loose. It's just, it's a mechanical thing rather than, you know, practical. Because, I mean, he used to have, like, people in costumes running out through aisles and stuff.
It was, like, set people in the audience to freak out. It was so much fun. There was a lot of love for the genre, and I think Jason and I both love Matinee.
Does kind of show somebody who was trying to take a, you know, experience beyond the norm for theaters. And I think maybe doing 3D today, you know, versus what, you know, they kind of started there in the 50s. I think the difference is now it feels like kind of a gimmick we're doing just to make money, as opposed to going, no, we love this and we're going to shoot this in a specific way that enhances it for the audience, that makes it cool. So
it goes back and forth today. I think there's a mix of those that obviously just wanted to add on to the box office revenue, and there's others that want to make an immersive experience, and there's others like Paul W. Sanderson, who wants to just use it as it was used, just in the latest special effects way possible, kind of still throwing things at. And you look at one of these Resident Evil movies or his Musketeer movie, and it's him throwing stuff at the screen to, you know, get a fun reaction out of the audience. I don't think he's doing it just to. I mean, he's using like James Cameron's technology to try to do the best he can at making the most over the top 3D movie he can.
Right. Yeah, it definitely can be fun. Like, I know Jimmy and I both.
Enjoy, like, my Bloody Valentine 3D.
Right. Exactly what I was going to say. Jimmy and I. Use it for fun. Absolutely. So.
Well, I gotta give you a shout out to Patrick Lussier. He really loves this stuff, and he's really inspired by it. And I think he does add that fun drive in feel to, you know, whether it's that or Drive Angry. Not everyone loved Drive Angry, but I had a blast, man.
I had a blast with the William Fichtner parts.
Yeah.
Patrick Lussier, his movies are turned out to be, I mean, they just have fun.
Yes.
And, matter of the and, concept. I really have a... Yeah, him and Todd Farmer together is a good pairing.
I agree. Shout out to those guys. Cheers.
We'll get there. That's another episode. No shout out. Cancel that shout out. Before we move on to the 60s, 50s, Hammer Horror was picking up quite a bit, wasn't it?
Toward the end of it, we had The Curse of Frankenstein, which was their first real...
Their first one.
...foray into what they were known for. That was 57, and then... And Horror of Dracula started, and that was the one that just boom.
And even, I guess even before Hammer, we still had, there were still kind of creature feet, monster, we talked about creatures, but like monster movies and, you know, the return of certain classic Universal characters was still certainly a thing during this time as well. I mean, we had
what is considered what their last true of the classic character icons, which is the Creature from the Black Lagoon, which was fitting of the radioactive monster movies and stuff at the time too, but they sort of consider that the last one, even though, like, you know, like Norman Bates was soon to come, and like Jaws can be considered a universal monster, but that's considered the last of like the classic ones.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, Jaws, I think, is a, I get where the logic is, because it's a universal movie and it's about a monster, but I mean, it's just something about the, you know, having quote unquote iconic performances portraying these characters. It makes a bit of a difference. I guess I can see where the kind of the separation comes in. Even something like Psycho, that's, well, I guess we'll get there next because it's the 60s, but
I was like, you jumping in there, because I was like,
that's a decade changer right there, man.
Yeah, we'll move into that in a second. I'm trying to think of what, well, we had the Dracula with what's that, with Cushing and
Christopher Lee. Yeah, the Horror of Dracula, or Dracula. Where it was like an action-packed, tight version of this Bram Stoker tale. And it, like, what I liked about that one is it took your preconceived notion and like kind of turned them on their head and gave you like a movie that was similar to the story, but really its own thing, which was pretty cool. And it moves really fast, too.
Oh. The Hammer Horror, that I would definitely feel that stuff holds up. It's so stylish and so just kind of elegant and crazy and so much fun. And Peter Cushing was always so good in those.
Peter Cushing was always so down for them, and Christopher Lee wasn't. That
mm-hmm.
was the
yeah, I know, right?
Well, because he was an actor. He's like, all right, I can make a movie.
But,
like
I mean,
this once
you never.
Twice.
I mean, you watch the movies. You could never tell he was unhappy though. That's a consummate professional. He was on it every time he played Dracula.
As I said, he was an actor.
Yeah.
He didn't have
the only thing. The only
on this movie.
The only clue you have is when he never leaves a location for a movie.
Yeah.
Lastly, we talked about Vincent Price. We talked about William Castle. There's also Roger Corman. Roger Corman certainly.
Right. Yep.
Roger Corman.
Little early Roger Corman there. He definitely got his stride in the '60s. But yeah, a couple of the Wasp.
Did the post
and
stuff start at the end of the '50s or?
No, the last one he did right before the end of the thing was the Wasp Woman. So then he started to get into the stuff with Vincent and in the '60s.
That's right.
Yeah. But he had a couple there.
I think Roger Corman's one of those guys that without him there would Jesus, look how many careers he started.
Yeah,
it's insane. And to this day,
we wouldn't have the Burbs guys because there'd be no Joe Dante.
No,
right. No the Burbs.
But hey, we wouldn't have so many other good ones. We wouldn't have the Howling. We wouldn't have the. And I'm sorry, I love Piranha.
I like
that.
The Burbs.
Piranha's good.
Piranha's awesome. Man.
But yeah, you know, no James Cameron either. So.
No, yeah. No,
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, Corman, for all the crap people gave him, and because he's basically for him being a cheapskate, but I kind of like that aspect of, like, you know, being creative with what you have and trying to make something for nothing rather than, you know, throwing like a ton of money at something and not seeing results. I love the, you know, you find the people who are talented and who have the best ideas by putting them in that situation where they have no money and have to figure out this big concept to put forth
and have one weekend off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
2 days to make a movie.
find one castle, use it for all your movies.
There you go. All right. Let's move into the '60s then. And, I guess let's start off with this thing, which we'll get back to when we get more towards the kind of the 80s. But we have two movies that I can bring up right now. There's Peeping Tom and there's Psycho, which are very, very, very early slasher movies, obviously.
Yes.
Right. Among other things, of course. But yeah, and not just slasher movies. They're prestige slasher movies. I mean, it's Michael Powell making Peeping Tom and Hitchcock making Psycho. I mean,
But they weren't like slasher movies at the time.
They were just movies that had a concept.
If someone got stabbed.
And we'll get to Psycho in a second, but Peeping Tom, Powell and he's even Powell and Pressburger is just Powell. But I mean, you have this kind of celebrated English film director making what was at the time kind of a controversial film, but it's.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know would it be an exploitation film at the time? Not really. It's just more of a, like, look how I can apply my colorful style and, you know, what I'm going for to this sort of film that's very different and very deranged in terms of what it involves. And you have these kind of POV shots and whatnot. I mean, it's interesting to watch this movie.
It holds up shockingly well. It's a terrifying film. I still, this is one of the scariest movies ever made. For a lot of reasons, that the lead performance is horrifying. That this movie still haunts me.
It's interesting that you would bring up. I'd forgotten. You know, again, how influential that movie was. You know, along with Psycho, I mean, it really did. If you look, you know, as those years of the '60s go on, it really did have quite an influence as to the next generation of what could be done. I mean, that kind of. You know, creature feature kind of thing definitely evolved into something different. And it was definitely because of those two films.
I like bringing up Peeping Tom because, and okay, I keep saying I'll get to Psycho. Psycho is my favorite horror movie of all time. So it's like, I can say plenty, but I don't really want to plan to, but I just wanted to talk about Peeping Tom a little bit because it's such an interesting counterpoint to Psycho because they both came out around the same time. Peeping Tom was, I believe, first, but in England, so, you know, just American audiences weren't exposed to it. But you look at movies like Halloween or, like, the first Friday the 13th film, and they use POV. They use a lot of, like, first-person perspective shots to show, like, horrible things happening. And that's, you know, you wouldn't really think that, like, an acclaimed English director of films like The Red Shoes was responsible for something that Carpenter or influenced Carpenter or the Friday the 13th, I can't think, Sean...
Cunningham?
Cunningham. Like, you wouldn't think that those were, you know, serve as influences, but that's what Peeping Tom kind of does.
I wouldn't say Sean Cunningham was too influenced by it, but Carpenter, because Cunningham was influenced by Carpenter.
There you go. Yeah. He might have talked to Carpenter and be like, what'd you do? He's like, I watched this movie Peeping Tom. So, I don't know.
No, it also pretty much destroyed Powell's career.
Yeah.
which unfortunately is a talented guy. It's strangely the backlash. People just were so disgusted and horrified back when it came out. But now it's revered as a classic.
So it's a shame. Speaking of, let's move to Psycho as well. So this is Alfred Hitchcock's film. It's based off the...
Wait, no, that came out in 1998.
Shut up.
Oh.
That movie does not exist, sir. it's a 1960s film. 1965.
Why remake a classic? That would be Psycho.
A lot of people say it's one of his best. I certainly would go that far. It's based
absolutely
on a very popular novel at the time. Was it even popular? I don't know. It was a novel at the time.
Yeah, I think it was popular.
Pretty solid.
It was another great combination of, you know, an amazing film, obviously, and using great gimmicks, you know, saying, hey, we're not going to allow anybody into the theater after the movie begins. And, you know, I mean, really, you know, Hitchcock was all about showmanship. So, it, you know,
the trailer, the bathroom.
Yeah. One of the best, definitely. He was, you know, but again, a master showman who matches it with a film that exceeds the expectations is why he was why that movie was so great.
That was also the beginning of, you know, really kind of testing the audience and going, hey, look at, she's the lead. Oh, look at this. You like this woman. Oh, yeah, don't.
Kill her.
You know, just that was brilliant. And it still is shocking and relevant to this day. It's such a fantastic way to make a movie. I love that.
It's one of the many things I love about this movie, how it literally shifts perspectives of who you're supposed to technically, like, quote unquote, root for throughout this movie. And like, and it does it pretty much three times. You get Marion Crane, who is technically, you know, a bad guy to an extent, but she takes the wrong actions, and then she tries to redeem herself and then gets murdered horribly. And then you get to, so then it's the Norman Bates show, who you still don't necessarily know is the bad guy, but you certainly know he's involved in the situation. He's off.
When your suspense lies in hoping he gets away with cleaning up the murder.
Yeah, which is a brilliant touch. And there's like little things in that performance. I mean, there's tons of things in that performance, but there's a small moment that I always love where he's like putting the car in the swamp, and like it stops for a second, and Norman Bates kind of looks at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it keeps going, and he kind of carries on with his ways. It's like, oh my god, this is amazing for what it's doing. And then then you get to like the third set of people, which Vera Miles, and who you're not necessarily following, but it's just the way it shifts perspectives and the way it just the whole way it came together. It's just such a fascinating and amazing movie. And with the sets and the music.
Bernard Reynolds still terrifies. You still hear that on every horror compilation album. It's that beautiful. I love that. It's creepy.
And also, go ahead.
I was gonna say, there's just so many creepy things that I still like. That the Clancy Brown looking sheriff. Or the apples were over. That guy is still creepy.
I call him No Eyes from Cool Hand Luke. I mean, he's just like that shot of him peering into the and the shot of him across the street. Those are like there's some and he's you know a member of the police. Like he's supposed to be the guy you can rely on to an extent. But
Hitchcock instills his own like fear of the police perfectly in that moment. Like his movies do have a lot of like paranoia when it comes to the law and stuff. Due to something with his that happened in his childhood, but like the best example of that happens in Psycho with her pulled over on the street, and it just works so well.
By the way, I love the Clancy Brown reference.
he looks exactly like Clancy Brown.
Who plays him in the is it Michael Remar?
James Remar.
The movie that doesn't exist.
I was going to say, you know, and you also have to really give kind of a hats off. Whenever I think of Psycho, I have to give a hats off to Anthony Perkins because he really created, you know, and of course that once you know, at the end, he really created you know, an interesting foil, an interesting villain, whatever you want to call it, out of somebody who was just kind of an average guy. And really, you know, most of the time, you know, we see horror as creatures or bad guys or whatever. And here was this very interesting, complex kind of, you know what I mean, character. And so to create that and create a performance that left you guessing and was interesting, and it really did set a tone that horror could house a performance or house performances that were layered.
For sure.
Yeah, and I mean, this is part we're talking right now. I mean, these were like Peeping Tom and Psycho, and then we'll probably talk about like Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead. We're kind of the in the seams movies, because like, you know, Hammer and Amick and like, you know, that and the Vincent Price Corman Poe stuff, that was like the dominant stuff during the decade. But they were slowly leading in the 70s. We have these like horror films that are sort of like grounding and bringing things back to kind of reality. Like, the popular stuff was like gothic horror and always taking place in like the 1800s and stuff like that. And these were slowly bringing it into like the real fold and making it feasible. Like Night of the Living Dead, you know, it's about zombies and stuff, but it's still played for practical and like, it, you know, like it's really happening. And that would sort of lead on to what the 70s would become. But these are like sort of the in the seams movies and weren't the dominant in the popular movie going fair.
Mm-hmm.
Like these weren't always happening, but this was the seeds being planted for the 70s.
And there was a lot of really exciting. You mentioned some great films. You also have to mention one of the best ghost stories ever made, and that is The Haunting.
Yeah.
Which is another miserable remake. But that film, the Robert Wise film, is. All these films were a little ahead of their time in some way. I got to actually speak to Robert Wise one time. About The Haunting, and there was a whole, if you remember the film, there's a very, very clear lesbian context with one of the characters, which the studio wasn't happy about. They wanted him to change one moment where she, like, I think she was the woman, Vera, I'm trying to remember her name, I'm blanking out, Olivia, oh, shoot.
Hold on.
Look it up for me.
Right.
Bloom, I think. It's annoying. But she,
Claire Bloom.
Claire Bloom, yes. And she's writing on the window, I hate you to somebody. And it was clear that was another woman. And they had them change that because, you know, she develops a liking for the leading lady. And I know they did a lot of stuff like that. Same with Night of the Living Dead. There were a lot of controversies surrounding its racially inspired ending. You know, there was a lot of chances being taken, or you know, like killing your leading lady off halfway through the movie. Yeah,
right. Well, Night of the Living Dead is that's another game changer, because it really could prove that you could make a, you know, a really small film, you know, and have it make the most amount of impact. And people, you know, that I remember, you know, my dad telling me about a very couple of specific movies, Psycho being one of them, and Night of the Living Dead, you know, seeing those in the theater and just freaked him right out. So and that movie when I was a kid, they showed that on the wall on a barn to my brothers and sisters who were a little older. And it freaked them out. And this was like, I mean, way later. So the impact of that movie is just, it's definitely felt.
Night of the Living Dead is another one like Godzilla, where you think about it, or you think about like the zombie genre and how that's progressed. And there's, you know, obviously there's zombies are already a subgenre of horror, and there's subgenres of zombie movies. I mean, there's so much there. But Night of the Living Dead, similar to like Godzilla, you look at that original movie and it's serious and stark, and you can maybe have fun with listening to people argue back and forth, which is part of what makes that movie work so much, because it's about the people and not the monsters.
Yeah.
But you get to scenes where like that explosion happens when their plan goes to shit, and you just have the dead eating the rest of what's left of them, and there's no humor there. It's just grisly stuff. It's just people eating flesh, or just things eating the flesh of people. And it's like that's terrifying to think about, I'd imagine. It's just like, they're dead, and now their remains are being chomped on by people. It's just horrible.
Well, at least it's cooked. I mean, it's barbecue.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Nice.
Do you know offhand what that was made of, by the way? It's like shit, like turkey and chocolate sauce or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like some nasty combination to make that effect work in black and white.
You know what really freaked me about Night of the Living Dead is that, you know, that little girl starts murdering her mom. That's messed up, man.
And then her dad, and then Dwayne Jones is supposed to go down and kill her because I can't deal with this.
Well, and the score during that time is just this off the wall creepy shriek sounds and like echoes, and it's just bizarre, and you just don't feel comfortable, and it's horrifying.
Yeah, the score is enough to maybe look past Judith Day's performance in that movie. That's for sure. It's
you know what? I actually kind of dig her performance because she's so freaking bat crap crazy. I can't say the other word, can I?
No. I dig it more now that I've seen it so many times. That's for sure.
Yeah. No, it kind of grows on you, and one of my complaints about horror movie fans, and this sounds bad, but the weird thing is, how many times have you been in a house, in a farmhouse, being attacked by zombies? How do you know someone wouldn't really react that way?
Right.
I mean, people react ridiculous in horror movies, but they're in ridiculous situations. I've never been chased by a zombie. I've never been chased by a guy with a knife or an axe. At least not yet. Well, actually, I did last
dream week. Dream to
dream. Kind of. But I dream the dream. But, you know, I mean, there's obviously bad performances, certainly, but you watch certain performances and you're like, well, you know what? They're nutty, and I got that with her. She's just like freaking out, and I think it really works for the film.
Well, another thing too is with people, the characters in horror movies and their reactions, they're also not real. They're not. They don't know they're in a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't seen like everything building up. It's its own universe, especially in older ones when things are just getting built. Like. They don't, like, okay, in a horror movie, I do that, because it's to them, it's, you know, it's real life, and, like, you wouldn't think of movies if you're, like, in that situation. You may later on, but the first initial panic and wave of things is fresh and new to you, and you're thinking of practical ideas, not film logic.
Now, but it's interesting, we talked about, you know, Psycho at the beginning, you know, because, you know, to taking a turn more towards the gore side, you know, you had some of Herschel Gordon Lewis's stuff, you know.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the threesome, you know, Blood Feast, 2000 Maniacs, you know, so it's interesting how some people went the way of, like, you know, Roger Corman and Vincent Price and that kind of thing, and then Herschel Gordon Lewis went the opposite way, you know, kind of took that, said, hey, you know, we didn't really get to see any of the actual gore, and went, okay, I think that's, you know, some of the first stuff that we saw in terms of gore and blood and that kind of stuff, and actually seeing that stuff that wasn't really allowed on screen.
We also have, like, Mario Bava's hitting it.
Right,
at the time
absolutely,
as well.
Yeah.
Who led in the Hall of Gallo. I mean, yeah, the 60s was a really exciting time for horror.
You have a lot of people coming from, you know, all over the world as well. Like, you have a lot of, you know, the American stuff is, that brings a lot more of the kind of, the quote-unquote gore and whatnot. We still have kind of the respected English filmmakers who wanted, you know, try to create tension and terror through the old-fashioned ways of doing horror, and, you know, they have actors like Peter Cushing who can lend a level of credence to certain things like that. Then you have, like, the Italian filmmakers who are just like, let's just make it really red. Let's just do that. Let's have some colors.
Everything's beautifully red.
It looks like nice red paint.
Like, some of my favorite horror movies to watch on Blu-ray are Italian, because I know their use of color is going to be outstanding, and if it's a good Blu-ray, it's going to look amazing.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Like, when we get to the 70s, we can talk about things like Torso or something like that, where it's like, oh, my God, look how great this movie looks.
Nice. But you still had, you know, some of the showmanship. Castle had done 7 movies, by the way, in the 60s, all with gimmicks and stuff, you know, from 13 Ghosts to Straight Jacket. And so you still had that stuff. I mean, it really is. 60s really was an eclectic group of old, new, odd. It's amazingly interesting if you really, you know, kind of research it and go through it. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we haven't even gotten to Rosemary's Baby, which led into the whole. Yeah. You know, it's funny when you I caught a lot of old TV movies, and I think we'll get more into this in the '70s. There's a lot, the idea of Satanism and cults and stuff was really obviously with the Charles Manson situation. There's a lot of fear of that, and again, we're talking politics and how politics affected the whole horror, the world of horror, and how people played on that. I think it was for Night of the Living Dead, or no, for Dawn of the Dead, we'll go into that, but I know the effects were kind of driven by Vietnam. So it's amazing how the 50s changed, just made it so political. All the horror really became, like you said, it became right at home, really.
I mean, yeah, it was in theme, and when you're watching it, you don't sort of realize it, but once you go back to study, you realize that, like, it was, you know, that's where the influence came from, the feel and everything. But yeah. It wasn't like, you know, it's obviously, whether intended by the director or not, it came out because that's the ways of the time and stuff. But it wasn't like overt, knock you over the head. But if you go back and look, like, yeah, that definitely was of its time. But yeah, like later absolutely. On, some stuff would be more overt and obvious. But like, yeah, during this time, it was just sort of happening that way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I guess you can't, you know, if you're making a movie and you're living in that time, you can't avoid it sometimes, especially if you're affected by it on a daily basis.
Just like, I mean, nowadays when there's movies that, you know, obviously come from, you know, the time of 9/11 and the reaction to that. And I don't think a lot of filmmakers intentionally make 9/11 relevant movies. It's just the times we live in and how
they're influenced and how it comes out in their writing, which can be
right, yeah.
Can be interesting.
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
It leads to some very interesting ideas for horror. We'll get there. But,
yeah.
But you, Jim, I think you mentioned Rosemary's Baby. I mean, yeah, the kind of the end of the 60s, it started to bring in more of that kind of demonic type horror, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely.
And a lot of grim outlook on life, too.
For sure, yeah. Not many happy endings in a lot of these horror movies, by the way.
No, especially that time, yeah.
Well, movies in general, too. I mean, they were starting to the end of the 60s and most of the 70s would take this grim tone of an outlook on life. I mean, even like at this time, like James Bond, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, is a movie where, you know, his wife is murdered at the end.
Yep.
It has this happy ending, but, you know, it has this grim ending to it. And, like, a lot of movies were heading this way, and horror was, like, leading the pack with stuff like Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living
well,
Dead.
That's neat.
Even a movie like Easy Rider. How
yeah.
awful is that ending?
You get that new wave. You get, like, Bonnie and Clyde. You get these
yeah.
movies that are,
yeah.
that are
yeah.
regardless of if they're based on true stories or not, you're getting movies that are made with the intention of not necessarily shocking audiences, but certainly providing them something different to experience, let alone not rely on having standard tropes be the way that dictates the plotting of these movies. It's,
mm-hmm.
yeah, something like Easy Rider is an experimental movie, and like something like Bonnie and Clyde is a movie that features a lot of blood and a lot of action and doesn't lead to anything that resembles a traditional romance between
no.
two people. It's more of like, look how, regardless of their intentions, look how, you know, insane this situation got, and look what the result was. It was a massive shootout and people died. Like, and that's your heroes right there. Or even something like The Graduate, where like we're getting all over the place in terms of genre now, but I mean,
yeah, I know.
It's a really, you know, eye-opening time in terms of cinema. And you bring it back to horror, and yeah, it's not just like, oh no, there's a threat. We got to get rid of this threat. Okay, good. Oh, there's a sequel. Oh, we got rid of it again. Now we have Rosemary's Baby, where you have we have darling Mia Farrow trying to deal with the fact that she's been impregnated by the devil. And by the end of that movie, it's not, oh man, good thing we got rid of that devil baby. It's okay, time to raise this devil baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's great. It's great. Oh, okay. So wait. So since we're in the 60s, I was going to say, and in keeping with the theme of movies all over the map, I would give two forgotten Friday flicks in this episode. The first one I would do on more the quirky comedic side would be The Little Shop of Horrors, the original
right.
Roger Corman film. Because everybody thinks of Little Shop of Horrors, they think of the musical and they think of the, you know, the film that Rick Moranis did. But of course, Roger Corman started it back in 1960 with this quirky little funny, wacky movie. And remember, you had mentioned Jack Nicholson is giving him his start. He had a cool little cameo in the movie, which was the role that Bill Murray played in the So great, funny, awesome, quirky little movie, black and white. It's unbelievably funny and unbelievably cool.
To be fair, I like that movie, but I really like the Rick Moranis musical movie.
I
think that movie's fantastic. I can just go over that movie.
And then I would say on the far side, I love Rosemary's Baby's great, but you might have forgotten the 1965 film that he did with Catherine Deneuve called Repulsion.
Repulsion, yeah, that's
oh,
great.
Yeah, yeah.
that's a
paranoia.
Right. And really shows, you know, in a confined space, what amazing things can be done to create fear and paranoia. And just, it's a rip roaring ride, man, that I know a lot of people may not remember, but it's early Roman Polanski. And again, I think it's right on par with Rosemary's Baby. Okay. So
has a very nice Criterion release too.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Polanski, who I credit as having, like, the worst life despite making some of the best films of all time.
Oh, I know, right?
Yeah.
Given everything he's got. Not just, like, the stuff that he's not in America for anymore, but just the stuff before that with this one between Manson and, you know, the Holocaust. Like, there's just these horrible things that have happened to this
awful,
man.
Awful, awful things.
But he's made, like, he's made some amazing films. And, Rosemary's Baby and Repulsion. I mean, he really knew how to cash in on the kind of the paranoia aspect that was going on during the Cold War. I mean, that's genre defining in a lot of ways for what he was doing. What else? Good picks, by the way. Jason.
Oh, do we get to do we get to do Forgotten Friday?
That's my article that I do on Fridays out of love, just to share my knowledge of the band. So I'm trying to in each of our decades here to pick a film that you may not remember, so that you can go back and enjoy your Halloween with it this year. So.
Yeah, Jimmy, if you want to do Sleepy Saturdays movies that you forgot about, generally watch on your couch.
There is a movie, one of my favorite 60s horror films. I think it's definitely found a sort of cult classic label now, but 1962 Carnival of Souls is a fantastic, creepy,
that's like one creepy of the first mind F movies.
Yes. Like, yes.
They're of all time, like art housey
and just a really this was kind of played on our fears and paranoias it had that nice little twist. What a fantastic little movie, and it that one holds up really well. And the ghosts or whatever they were, the zombies or whatever they were just creepy. I got that guy on my a shirt, and it's just like, that guy's scary as hell, man.
I think that movie's like almost perfection. It's like
it
holds up. I mean, and thanks to it being in black and white too, like that adds to the creepiness. And some of the makeup probably might have not worked in color, but man, it's
probably not
effective. Like all the mirror images and stuff. And, I mean, that movie is just haunting in its own right. And I caught that. First time I caught that was like on a Sci-Fi Channel in like the early 90s used to do like horror movie marathons where they do one a night, and like I think like Rob Zombie hosted or something. They showed that movie, and like even watching it on TV, I was just mesmerized. And it sucks that thing's in like public domain and there's no proper like Blu-ray release or anything for it.
It's very sad. It's honestly one of my favorite films of that era, and a really beautiful, really great movie. We're missing
score.
So many movies. Yeah, the score is fantastic.
That's an Oregon score. That's a creepy score.
Yes, yeah. Every year, that is one of my mainstays. Unfortunately, like you said, it's got the crappy, DVD release. We need a real nice version of it, which...
They put it on Blu-ray last year in like a collection, but all the films in the collection were 480i. So it was like, what was the point?
Yeah.
Why'd you do that?
Why even bother?
So. I can see that coming out as a eventual release.
Somebody, I mean, it's public domain. Like Criterion's put out public domain Hitchcock movies before, and this would, I think this would sell.
I think a lot of people, it's definitely become found its fame throughout the years, and I think people have really, I know when I have that shirt, people notice it. People are like, that, and they, jumping decades a little bit, but Insidious owes a lot. Carnival of Souls. I mean, almost identical in some moment. In some moments. So if you're a fan of Insidious and you haven't seen Carnival of Souls, highly, highly, highly recommend seeing that film.
It's fun when we get to the kind of that more the modern era of horror, and we can talk about the movies that are clearly influenced by a lot of these older movies, and the ones that seem to kind of do a good job of representing the fact that it's out of love, as opposed to just saying, like, look at how we ripped off this thing, but don't tell anybody.
Exactly.
Like, there's certainly movies, I think, that kind of, you can see where some are influenced in the kind of the good way, and some are influenced in kind of the we did this because, yeah, it looked cool.
Like, yeah, and just to make it clear, James Wan clearly does that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He seriously loves the earlier films, and he pays a really wonderful homage to it, so it's, yeah.
I was at an early Q&A, I mean, we'll get to Insidious, but I was at an early Q&A about Insidious with him and Lee Wannell talking about their influences and how that kind of, because that advertising that movie kind of puts it one way, but it's certainly influenced by other things beyond just like, it's a haunted house. There's way more going on in Insidious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of people point to Poltergeist, but there's plenty of other influences.
Oh, yeah,
It's
like, no, they went a little farther than the 80s to find a movie that they could reference for these things.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about this because I thought this was kind of neat. I mean, the 60s and the 50s, you get a lot more color. But there's still a lot of black. There's still a lot of black and white as well, in terms of kind of the horror movies we're seeing.
And black and white was by choice too for a lot of them.
Yeah, sometimes it was for budget limitations, but other times it was because this is how we made movies. this is where we see the more kind of effective stuff coming out. I'm trying to think of do you guys have last black and white movies that you kind of enjoyed seeing as the years kind of progressed further and further.
Mm.
Like Carnival of Souls,
like
obviously.
The 60s?
Yeah, in the 60s. Like Psycho's an obvious example, or in Carnival of Souls we just mentioned.
I think we mentioned a lot that I can think
how,
about.
How far did Hammer Horror go as far as going back and forth between black and white? Did they just stop doing black and white altogether at one point and just go strictly to horror? Or was it still kind of shape-shifting?
Honestly, I don't remember. I'm trying to think when...
I don't know when there was color. I mean, the films themselves went, I think, to about mid 70s, right? 74, around there?
Probably something like that.
This is where that lack of research really comes in.
Yes.
Where we do what we can to get this going.
I think for the next one, we may actually have to do a little research.
I mean,
maybe. Maybe.
I still think as we get closer and closer, I think the 70s will be a lot easier.
From the 70s on, it's going to be off our heads a lot easier.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what else can we talk about as far as the 60s go?
The thing is, looking back on it, there's so much Witchfinder General. There's a lot of really great films, Die Monster Die, that... I don't know. It's an interesting decade, and I think we've covered a lot of it. There was such a variety. It also, there was, you were talking about Herschel Gordon Lewis, all these fascinating Roger Corman guys that kind of are still looked upon today and became inspirations for so many people. I think it'll be interesting to see, like you said, how many of these names pop up when we start looking at the 70s, 80s, especially the 90s.
I was going to say, another thing, too, with this decade that I can think of is that it's the last decade where the films actually, looked pretty. They started getting a little more grimy, a little more haunting. Everything, a lot of the horror films of this era, the Corman Poe stuff, the Hammer, were shot with the same sort of, filmmaking as any other genre. It's just their set decorating and costuming was a little different, but I mean they all have a similar look to other films, and horror starts to take its own kind of vibe in the 70s with grittier looking movies and different lighting schemes and stuff like that. But I mean the films of the 60s seem to be well lit, pretty Technicolor.
That's interesting because some of that comes from just kind of the style of the time, but we mentioned kind of in the past that there are a lot of movies being made in the, the 30s and 40s. It's not I mentioned kind of ratios, but there's certainly a lot of movies being made regardless of, the budgets or whatnot. And you look at 50s, 60s, and yeah, I mean, it's still kind of that way. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot more care to production value in terms of traditional filmmaking, whereas the 70s and onwards, we'll get to kind of the more independent filmmaking scheme of turning out horror movies. So it's not, I guess it's not like it's different in terms of the amount of films being made, but, and even, the style of which they're made, but it's certainly, there's a shift in terms of the look of these movies, like you're saying, and it is going to kind of not degrade in quality, but certainly have a different visual aesthetic because of the approach they're taking in making these movies, I guess.
Well, Night of the Living Dead is a classic example of that.
For sure, yeah.
Of the idea that you could make, I mean, if you look at a lot of these horror movies, they probably think, oh, you know, there was a lot of makeup. There's a lot of, you know, special effects, you know, these movies are really expensive to make. And that was one of the first movies that just was like a pick up a camera and make a movie kind of thing. And so that started a movement, definitely, that showed that, hey, you could make an effective, you know, a topical horror movie for little money. So I think that was one of that movie was also kind of the birth of that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, him and Roger Corman, obviously.
Right, right.
You know, obviously. But, it's... what a great decade. You know what we forgot to talk about? One of my favorites?
Hmm.
Spider Baby. I love that movie so much. I'm like, dang. You know what? I'm just going through. I'm, like, looking at... We could talk for hours about all these great movies, and I think they were all... I think it's a safe bet that we were all inspired by many of these, and as all of us, and that it kind of shaped our way, not only for filmmakers, but I think it shaped our ways as viewers for what we found terrifying as children, and what we kind of brought with us into adulthood, and why we love horror films. I mean, at least I know for me it did.
Oh, hey, one more. Here, I'll slide one more in there for you from 1965. It's probably a creepy movie, little movie you never heard of called The Collector. With Terrence Stamp and Samantha Agar. It's one of the first kind of creepy obsession kidnap flicks where it's Terrence Stamp playing a guy who's a butterfly collector and then decides to collect human beings. So
It's not necessarily horror. It's also drama, romance.
Right. Yeah, romance. Yeah.
That's what they used to call dating.
Right.
That's a William Wyler film, too.
Yeah.
it's not known for making those kind of movies.
Right. But it's definitely got a creepy factor. Terrence Stamp
has that weird
creepy factor. So I would throw that in there as something to check out for something odd and weird.
Jimmy,
and
you know why? Jimmy, was hot. You know why I'll allow it? Because I kneel before Zod. So it's a.
And Jimmy loves Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, so we're all good.
There's also Incubus. That's another film that I was just thinking about with Shatner. I was like, I was looking around these years. That's just a weird movie, but I just wanted to bring it up.
And Bandit's good, though. Just kidding.
What else? Anything else we can talk about in this decade, or should we just wrap it up?
I think we can wrap it up. I think we've done about as much research.
I mean, this will be like looking through a list, going, okay, this film.
That's a movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know exactly. What? No, I forgot. You know what? There's a. I mean, I mentioned, you know, the kind of different nations that are bringing in horror films. Japanese horror was certainly picking up a lot here too. Like they've moved kind of past the. Oh, I mean, they're still making Godzilla movies, but certainly moved past the. The initial like outbreak of Godzilla films and into kind of more like let's make really weird horror movies, and we'll kind of get into it I think more as we carry on to the decades, because Japanese horror cinema is quite strange.
But
it certainly had some origins coming back in the 60s. I'll just say that for now, because I know there is.
We also had the early franchising too. I mean, we had the Hammer with the Hammer. We had the Dracula franchise, which through the 60s, from late 50s through the early 70s, ran off 9 entries. And then you had like the Frankenstein ones and the Mummy. I mean, this was like, you know, your precursors to the like Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street dominated the 80s. You had these in the 70s. And there's structurally, there's some similar qualities between the two. It's kind of interesting.
Absolutely.
You know how they raise back Dracula and how they finish him in every movie. Kind of, you know, same thing as every Jason movie starts out.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot. I've been, you know, writing recently about the Hammer Dracula films, and it's been interesting to see the mirroring of each other between that and like Friday the 13th. It's been kind of interesting.
All right. Well, with that, I guess let's just wrap it up then. Let's wrap it up so we can save everything for next week's show when we talk about the 70s, only the 70s. Cause I think there's a lot there to talk about. We'll get to more. Yeah.
Disco Funk and the Omen. Yeah.
Disco Funk, the Omen, more zombie stuff, a lot more comedy horror. Comedy horror really kind of kicks in around this time as well, let alone a few names like Carpenter and Spielberg seem to be around at this time. But we'll get there. But for now, with all that said, where can people find more of your work, Jason?
You can go to starpulse.com. And again, we're this month, I'm for my Forgotten Friday flick, I'm featuring the works of Frank Henenlotter. So last week was Basket Case, and more stuff coming up. So you can check it out at starpulse.com.
Yay.
Jason? Jason. Brandon?
You can find my work at Naptown Nerd, which is naptownnerd.blogspot.com. Currently writing about the Hammer Dracula series, and I also do Blu-ray reviews at whysoblue.com, and I co-host with Aaron and Maxwell Haddad the Ichapod Cranecast, which follows the episodic adventures of Sleepy Hollow on Fox.
Studio.
You can find me at joblow.com and arrowintheheadcom, where I write a couple of articles on old movie stars, ironically enough. Recently, Samantha Agar, so thank you for bringing that up, Jason Coleman.
Oh, yes.
You can find me on Twitter, JimmyToTheO, and Facebook, James Oster, Instagram, JimmyToTheO. I'm all over the place. And I've got a new movie coming out, which I may bring up later.
Shamelessly plugging his own.
Hey, I am beaten and bruised to make this movie, so yeah.
So you can find more of my work at thecodeofzeke.com. You can also find me at Why So Blue. I'm at Twitter at Aaron's PS4, and as Brandon mentioned, I host the Ichapod Cranecast as well. I had a whole thing right now for the 70s, I forgot. Yeah, we're going to talk about counterculture, evil children, grittiness, experimentation, the rise of bloodshed, Cronenberg, and comedy horror. That's next week's 70s show. But you can, of course, find all the other episodes about Now, Theron, and Abe on iTunes, HHWLOD, that's the network that hosts our show. Also at Stitcher, SoundCloud, Podomatic, all the places you can find podcasts, pretty much. Email us at outnowpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts on these couple decades in horror. I completely forgot to mention this. We have a contest. I have a contest I wanted to announce.
That's nuts.
I meant to put that in the notes. So I'm going to announce it right now, and I'm going to announce it on the main show of Out Now with Aaron and Abe as well. But because we're doing this kind of decade-by-decade horror podcast series, I figured if you guys email us or put it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/outnowpodcast, in like a message or some way, we'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on like your favorite horror movies from each individual decade. So if you're able to do that from like the 20s up to now, we'll kind of, the number of people that do that will kind of put you into a raffle, and I have a bunch of horror movies that I can give away.
Nice.
So yeah, just email us outnowpodcast@gmail.com. We're going to put it on our Facebook page for the listeners of the show, not the guests, Jimmy.
I was going to ask. I was like, yeah, I'm going to enter this, man.
But you don't need it. You're a big star. You pay for it yourself.
Basically, yeah. If you have like a list of horror movies from like one from each decade. I mean, you could skip one or two decades if you really don't have like a favorite 20s.
No, you have to do the 20s.
No, you heard Jimmy. Never mind.
Has to be a hidden gem.
Yes. Has to be every decade.
There's enough movies you could pick from. Come on.
There you go. Okay, so give us a list of your horror movies from each decade that you really love, and I'll put you into the raffle, and we'll see who wins. I'm looking on my floor, and I have like a whole bunch of a stack of Blu-rays. I know a bunch of them are horror Blu-rays, so yeah, I'd love to ship those out to a winner for, you know, sticking with us through these horror
including
episodes.
Including Hey, Scared Stupid and Sharknado 2, the second one.
Woo! And hey, let's give horror movie fans credit. Most horror fans know their decades,
yeah.
And they know this stuff even back to the 20s because you know they're true fans and they love this stuff. So come
that's
on,
the one genre where everybody
it.
Does their homework and research and wants to know more and more and more.
Unless we're doing a podcast about it, then we don't do the research as much.
Okay, let's wrap it up. Let's stop there. We'll come back when we get to the 70s, the gritty 70s. And but yeah, thank you, Jimmy, Jason, and Brandon for joining me today to discuss the 50s and 60s.
Thank you for having us join.
Yeah, thank you.
And ideally, we'll be able to, once again, properly schedule this episode so we can all be back for the next one where we can have, I'm sure, a lot of time devoted to a lot of horror movies that came out of the 70s period. But until next time, that's it. So long and goodbye.
Is Jimmy awesome. Is Jimmy O going to review his own film?
Heck no.
we'll do that.
Can we put a podcast together where we just review the films of Jimmy
O? That'll be the sixth week of October.
Halloween hangover.
Well, see, I can't really talk about it until we talk about the recent horror films, because obviously it's going to be very influential in the future.
I assume you were influenced by Spider Baby to make this movie. So.
Yeah. Of course. No, I did. I have an inspiration. I was inspired by Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I'll tell you why later.
Oh, because you dance like Leatherface. I get it.
No. I do the one of my favorite.
The trucker shuffle.
One of my favorite kills is when he knocks that guy in the head and you see his body just trembling.
Oh, yeah.
I get hit by a car, I get stabbed in the neck, and I get shot in the shoulder and the elbow and through the hand. So I kind of, and I don't die, ironically enough. My body's just a shaking, like, corpse of jello of a man, and it was fun. I kept thinking of, hey, that guy from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that was a cool kill. So that's what I was influenced by. That's what I did, baby. It was fun.